the Senate Education Committee will come to order. And I've had some comments from people that are at the table that sometimes have had difficulty hearing because of side conversations. So if in fact you're tempted to get into conversations instead of engaged with the issues of the day, I would appreciate if you would take that conversation out in the hall. So thank you very much for that attentiveness. But we're looking forward to, I hope, a captivating presentation today that from which we all can benefit, and so that you're going to want to hear every word. And that goes for us as well. So I'm going to welcome, first of all, to our session on effective schools and data use, Charlie Weaver, who is the Executive Director of Minnesota Business Partnership. Kick it off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I probably won't be captivating, but the people that are going to follow me will be. And those are some principals who are doing great things in their schools, and they are terrific. What I'd like to do is just start by...
Say your name for the record.
Sorry, Charlie Weaver. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is just tell you a little bit about the award program that we have that established and has recognized the people you're going to hear from today and what that's about, and then mostly turn it over to them to talk with you about what's working, what isn't working in our schools. Education has been a core issue for the Minnesota Business Partnership since we were formed more than 30 years ago. Our members, who are the CEOs of the largest companies in the state, recognized pretty quickly that kind of the key to growing jobs, if this legislature is all about jobs, 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 it's kind of what we're all about, we can't succeed if we don't have good education. Our companies have put education at the top of the agenda because without a good workforce, they simply aren't going to stay in Minnesota. So there's nothing more important to them than having an educated, skilled workforce here in Minnesota. And as we've sought to make sure that all the kids in Minnesota get the best education possible, one claim that's always frustrated us at the partnership has been that poor kids, kids of color, or those from bad family situations can't learn. It's what a lot of people call the soft bigotry of low expectations. It's real, it permeates the education establishment, and it really makes us mad. So, and frankly, Madam Chair and members, if you look at the demographics of where the state is right now and where the state's going in terms of a rising immigrant population, overall decrease, and other kids graduating from our schools, if we don't figure out a way to deal with kids of color, kids in poverty, especially inner-city kids, if we don't figure that out, we aren't going to have a workforce that can work at the Medtronics and the Targets and the 3Ms and the Best Buys and the Cargills of the world. So it's really critical. So we decided about 5 years ago at the partnership to prove that theory wrong, the theory that somehow black kids or poor kids or kids with disadvantage or bad families can't learn. And what we did was we wanted to highlight the success stories around Minnesota, schools that are succeeding despite those odds, and to show that all students can succeed and share the strategies at these schools so that no one can use that excuse anymore about kids' inability to learn. So here's the test that we used. We said we're going to find schools from across Minnesota that serve high concentrations of low-income students, large numbers of students of color, but they also have high test scores. And we found these schools, and we've recognized two of them each of the last 5 years. I think in your packets you've got just a copy of a sheet that kind of talks about what the kind of the parameters of our awards are. And then we invite these two schools, one metro, one rural, to our annual meeting every year. We recognize them. We give them $10,000, and they love it, but the $10,000 is no strings attached, right? We don't tell them, oh, you have to use it on this, you have to use it on that. I think Troy Vincent, who you're going to hear from, helped send some of his kids down to the NASA Space Center. Others have used it for other reasons. So we give them some cash. Sometimes they tell their superintendents, I think. Sometimes they don't. But they get the cash anyway, and we give them some computers. And we found, as over the last 5 years, as we've dealt with these 10 different principals, that there's no secret, really, to their success. They all do a very few things well. And the five kind of common traits that we've found among these principals are, number one, you have a great school leader. These principals are inspirational. You're going to hear from them in a second. It'll be obvious to you, I think, why they succeed and why their schools succeed. So great school leader, great teachers, who are part of a team. They're all working toward the same objective. They all try to work with the families. In many cases, that's really hard in some of these neighborhoods and some of these areas. There just aren't parents around or families around, but they try to find someone to work with the kids, and it may be the custodian, it may be the cook, or some mentor that they work with. Fourth, they all use data to get better. So they measure themselves, they measure the teachers, they measure the students. And then last, they don't accept failure as an option. There's a culture at each of these schools, and I visited most of these schools, there's a culture there that failure isn't an option. And it permeates the whole school. It's not just the principal, not just the teacher. You talk to the custodian, he is committed to the notion, or she is, that they aren't going to allow those kids to fail, and any excuses simply are not tolerated. So that's been the experience with these 10 superintendents. And then 2 years ago, and I think, Madam Chair, maybe we'll be talking to this committee about this on Monday, but we commissioned with the McKinsey a worldwide study of what works and what doesn't work in schools. We'll talk about that maybe more on Monday, but not surprisingly, the same factors were what McKinsey identified in the best schools in the world. Great teachers, great principals, good data. It's not a mystery. It's not education. The advantage, I think, Madam Chair, we have is that this isn't a case where we don't know what works. We know what works. And it's not money. This is what the McKinsey study found. It's not class size. It's great principals. It's great teachers. It's good data. It's inspirational leadership. And then it's not tolerating failure. So today I want to introduce to you my heroes. These are three principals who've come from the schools that we've awarded over the last 5 years. They are terrific. They're inspirational. I think they'll tell you much better than I can, Madam Chair, what it takes to succeed in these schools despite very tough and difficult odds.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver. Do you want to introduce them, or shall I call them up?
Okay. Thank you.
Why don't you all three come up? Troy Vincent, principal of Farnsworth Aerospace Magnet. Mary Lou Martins, principal at Sibley East Gaylord Elementary, and Mary Donaldson, director of Concordia Creative Learning Academy. I think I've had an opportunity to congratulate some of you in person when you received your award, but I'll do it again. Congratulations on getting this recognition and proving it can be done, and we're looking forward to hearing your story. We'll start with Troy Vincent. If you'll say their name for the public record, we'll appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Troy Vincent, and I'm principal at Farnsworth Aerospace Magnet School here in St. Paul. And fellow senators, it is an extreme pleasure to be in your presence this afternoon, and to make this report to you. I understand the quest is to tell you a little bit about what we are doing and why we have been so recognized. It is truly, truly an honor to be able to stand before you to say that we believe in public education. We believe in educating all of the students. You will hear, you have heard perhaps, that everybody talks about high expectations. And it's more than a rhetoric. It is something that must be brought to life. You must do it. It takes action. It takes perseverance. It takes hard work to have high expectations. And to define it, that truly means leave no child behind and try to help each and everyone meet their success or their full potential. I'm very humbled about the success that I've made because I'm never satisfied. It's not good to be a leader and feel that you have arrived. So I've never arrived, and I'm always constantly looking for ways to improve and to get better. So with that caveat, I want to let you know that I am also very proud of the success that we've had. And let me tell you a little bit about that success. Since the inception of the No Child Left Behind and ranking schools, we've been fortunate to make AYP and to have steady incremental growth. And we all know that test scores in and of itself is not the only thing that makes a successful school, but it is a high stakes. That is what the public looks at, that's what you expect, and that's what people measure. So we work hard to make sure that our students learn how to successfully take a test. And that requires skills. Now, yes, we are an aerospace school with a focus on science, but truly, we try to have a liberal arts education as well. We use our aerospace to develop problem solving and to touch each and every subject, the arts, the humanities, history, social studies, and I can give you countless examples where we integrate aerospace. There are hundreds of careers that embark upon the aerospace science. And so we have taken that. Now, why aerospace? We changed about 6 years ago because we were hearing and reading the reports, not only from Minnesota, but nationally, that our students were not doing well in science. And so in science and engineering, and people were requiring and asking us to do more with science, technology, engineering, and math. We heard the call. We took it very, very seriously. And as such, we are increasing our rigor, and rigor in science, math, and math in particular. We have a number of youngsters who suffer from what we call math phobia because they become afraid of it very early in their school career. So we have to unlock those fears and work very, very hard and take step by step, task analyze everything. You know, and then a lot of times they hear that from their parents and people in the community. Oh, I was not good at math when I was a child. And the more those babies hear that, the more it creates a problem for us. So we do take a look at that as well. As we look at data, we have become a data-driven institution. And those of us who are trying to make these incremental groups, and just about everybody, really are taking a strong look. We're asking teachers to change their vernacular or their conversations about kids. There was a time that we talked about, oh, this child couldn't learn because of problems at home or what mom is doing or dad is doing or poverty. We made a wealth of excuses, and we don't allow excuses. Yes, my school is 80% and above with free and reduced lunch, and it is a poor school, but I'm here to testify to you and before you this afternoon that they don't think they're poor. We cannot allow them to think that they don't have, because the minute they embrace that thinking, everything we do becomes for those people, for them, and never for themselves. So we are very adamant about making those children feel as if they can do and be anything, and that they have, that they're rich. And they may not be rich financially, but they're rich in spirit. And we try to teach them their strengths, teach them to be resilient. We do not accept excuses. It does not matter. And aerospace for us has been an equalizer, because unless your parents are engineers and doctors and scientists, then all of the students come pretty much at the same level. So we use our aerospace to work on that, and so they can feel that they're a part of it. Our curriculum is divided into three areas. One, direct instruction. That's all of the things that occur in the classroom, directly from the teacher to the student. The second part of our curriculum is we bring in experts. We bring in scientists. Of course, we have astronauts every year visiting our building. And then we bring in musicians, authors, you name it. If they have something to share with these youngsters, they become experts. Many of our parents, we try to use them to be experts. And that's a new area for us in terms of making parents partners in the teaching process. We have to, you know, teach them, don't be afraid of the math. Teach them how to work with their homework with kids. We have a lot of our children who are having a very difficult time connecting with many of the texts that they're exposed to because they don't have the background knowledge. The majority of my students are second language learners. But that's not an excuse. You know, we take them and work with them so that we can give them the best that they can be and make them. When we talk about high expectations, we're talking about requirements. In my building, every child from kindergarten through eighth grade must participate in a science fair. That is not an option. We want children to think scientifically. And if we want to use that scientific base to expand to other areas, areas of business, law, politics, community service, just all the jobs require science, math. The technology piece is coming easy. We're very proud to say that right now we're currently one of the only schools in the states that on Monday will be connecting with a school in Apple Valley, California, and we'll be doing some research on Jupiter, planet Jupiter, collecting data, tracking it. Is that on a test? No, but we're getting kids to think beyond. You know, it's our business to help protect this planet and beyond. We have to do that. Minnesota historically has been a leader in this country for education, and we cannot let it go down. And I have every bit, I'm on this drive. You know, I don't want people saying we have to go across the seas to find good technology people, good math students, good math workers. Workers are right here in this state, in this city. And I know that as members of this committee that you are determined to see that happen. And I'm one of the troopers that will make sure that your work is accomplished. I don't know. I know my time is high. It's low. But I'm excited. Limited. And I'm proud. And know that the work is never done. And each year, you know, when we market, we don't only market to high-level students. We market to some challenges as well. So our crops change every year. And some students come to us very far behind, and we have the arduous task of getting them up to speed. Requirements, you know, I'm so happy. You know, everybody's talking about the weather and the snow. You know, we're here. This is part. We have to get our youngsters to understand that this is climate, understand climatology, understand what's happening in the world. And let's take it, it's happening all over the country, all over the world. Understand it. And in this case, enjoy it. And that's why we're going to be in the Winter Carnival on Saturday night. Because if any of you are there, you will see my band, 150 strong, grade 5 through 8. And that's because I want these babies to really connect with this great city and this great state. And to whom much is given, much is expected. And I give these youngsters a lot. You give the youngsters a lot. We expect it, and we will not offer any excuses and continue to move forward. We're sharing. We're sharing with schools on Anoka Hennepin, is now coming to adopt, implement an aerospace school. We've got a school in Rochester. We've been getting calls from Kansas City. We've got one from Alabama. You know, people have been coming to us to learn from us, and we're very, very happy to share. Are we perfect? No, there are no perfect institutions, but we are certainly struggling to be the very, very best that we can be. And so I thank you for this opportunity. I thank the Minnesota Business Partnership for their inspiration and for their faith. And that's part of it. When people expect schools to do well, we rise to the occasion. When you expect us to do well, we rise to the occasion. And we will not offer any excuses and get the job done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent. You are inspiring. Are there questions that from members? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's a little bit of a kid in all of us throughout our life. And one of the things that I can clearly remember when I was sitting in class many, many years ago was looking out the window, watching things go on when a class was not exactly interesting. You know, I mean, it was in a different place than my mind was. And I think what I sense you've attempted to do is to catch the attention of your students in a way that brings them in the fold, so to speak, wanting to learn. And I think that desire to want to learn has to be touched before students really can kind of become part of, have the interest to learn. And I think that the problem that I think I see anyway in many schools is that they have, 40 kids in a class, and it's kind of managing chaos versus the experience of learning. And I was wondering if the aerospace concept is something that was designed to try to catch those children's interest.
It's certainly,
Mr. Vincent.
Senator Stump. My eyes.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you for that question, and it is true. We think that aerospace captures the imagination. Children can dream. They can vision about what's happening. And when we were studying this, there were two things that we found our second and third graders liked: dinosaurs and rockets. Well, we couldn't have a curriculum built around dinosaurs. So of course the next best thing was then rocket. And as such, we have a very good working relationship with many, many partners that are associated with the aerospace industry.
Sure.
And so that's part of the experts that come in, the imagination, taking students out to the Kennedy Space Center, Johnson Space Center, watching a launch. The last launch is coming, and we're doing fundraisers and whatever to try to send a group of youngsters and their parents to see that launch. And it's a little nerve-wracking because of delays and all other things, but we're going to certainly take a stab at it. But certainly their curiosity is enhanced. And that's why we talk about Jupiter, the solar system, the stars, astronomy, climate, and also national security as well.
Right. Well, thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Principal Vincent, thank you for the great overview and presentation. I really admire your passion and your dedication and your no-excuse position towards making sure all children learn. I'm wondering if you can just tell me a little bit more about your school. I know you said it was grade 5 through 8 and 150 students.
No, but it's pre-K 8. I'm sorry. I apologize. We were pre-K 6 for many, many years, and many of the parents wanted to expand to grade 7 and 8. And 3 years ago, the superintendent heard the parents, and they heard that the parents wanted to expand the aerospace concept to 7th and 8th. So for the third, we are now in our third year of being a pre-K 8 school. And next year, we're hoping to expand. In fact, it's in the works that we're going K-12, with the expansion being at Johnson High School on Arcade. We're trying to make the Arcade, which is the east side of St. Paul, we're trying to make that an academic corridor focusing on STEM with aerospace as its focus. One of the things, and I don't want to change the acronym from STEM, S-T-E-M, but we are talking about STEAM, S-T-E-A-M, and putting aerospace in the middle of it. I don't know how the superintendent is going to look at that one. Well, we will certainly be asking.
I'm going to kind of slow down the questions here because I think we want to hear all three of you.
Yes,
and hold some of your questions and ask for all of them. Would you mind doing that?
Madam Chair, I'm not going to ask the gentleman a question. I just wondered if each person could maybe discuss where they place reading in terms of priority.
Okay. And
so,
thank you, Senator Scheid. Close to my heart, so how could I deny that? So, Mary Lou Martins.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Lou Martins, and I'm the principal at Sibley East Schools. I am the principal of two schools, and one is in Gaylord, Minnesota, and one is in Arlington, Minnesota. And I, too, am honored to be here today, and I feel very privileged, but I don't know that I can add the word pleasurable like Vincent did. I'm a little nervous sitting before you. You're a little intimidating, so I will do
Relax.
My best.
It's
the
Relax.
First time I've ever been here. So anyway, I'd like to talk today about one of my schools, Gaylord Elementary. The Gaylord Elementary School is part of the Sibley East School District, and it's comprised of students from the cities of Gaylord, Arlington, and Green Isle. Gaylord Elementary is located in Gaylord. Gaylord is located on the shores of Lake Titlow. The community is approximately 50 miles southwest of Minneapolis and St. Paul. The population was 2,279 in the 2000 census. It's the county seat of Sibley County. According to the government data, the average salary for jobs in Gaylord is about $25,000, and the median income of households in Gaylord is about $39,000. The student population at the Gaylord Elementary is 363 students, with 58.4% of those students qualifying for free and reduced lunch. Student ethnicity is 39% Hispanic, 3% Asian, 1% Black, and 57% White. 33% of our students speak English as a second language. Our school has demonstrated remarkable improvement in the academic areas. But in addition to that, we've also demonstrated improved positive involvement through good attendance and fewer discipline referrals. They've shown resilience behaviors by learning to make good choices, and they have a sense of purpose for the future. Our classrooms are safe and they're orderly. The class environment is saturated with positive interactions among peers as well as between teachers and students. Students feel free to take risks when sharing and answering questions. We use the responsive classroom approach in our classrooms. We believe that knowing the students we teach individually, culturally, and developmentally is as important as the content we teach. We know that with adults, the greatest cognitive growth will occur within social interaction. So, how did we get our kids to succeed? There are two things. Actually, there are a number of different factors, but I'd like to address two factors with you today. The first is effective leadership, and the second is what I think you're going to hear over and over again, is high expectations for all students. First, effective leadership. Leadership in our school lies within the school, and I have to admit, not in the principal's chair. Long-lasting improvement cannot be dependent of a single person or of outside forces. We work hard to develop a shared vision and a commitment to the work of improvement. That includes everyone, from administration, teachers, paras, lunchroom supervisors, everyone. Another thing we do that promotes leadership is we have teacher collaboration teams. This has been our most successful staff development and has led to extremely high teacher efficacy. Teams, in my perspective, have always outperformed individuals. At our teacher collaboration teams, which we meet monthly, we discuss many different things. But one of the important things is it gives us a chance to reflect. Reflective practice will lead to consistent innovation. And sometimes innovation is not really wild and crazy things, but it enables us to reconsider how we're doing things, which can lead to new and better approaches to our work or different approaches for different students. During these times, we've also worked on developing formative assessments, and we analyze student work samples. Together as a team, they develop an assessment that's going to match a standard that they're teaching to, and then they bring the work back and they see who's meeting the mark, who isn't, which direction did you take when you were teaching that lesson, and that develops a shared responsibility for student success. Also, leadership opportunities have come. I've had the opportunity to attend the Principal's Academy a number of years back, and I've been part of that group. And it's been one of the best trainings I've ever had. It was very coherent and consistent, and it put together for us what a standards-based system looks like and how you get kids from point A to point B. I'm also a part of MESPA, the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, where we network with principals in the Southwest area. We call each other, we get ideas, and we work with each other's teachers, actually. We have strong mentorship programs, and we also take advantage of the integration program where we collaborate with Belle Plaine and Nicollet, and we get together as teams and work towards student achievement in that way. The second thing I'd like to talk about is high expectations for all students, no matter what. And I think Mr. Weaver mentioned that failure is not an option. That's kind of a prevailing mantra, if you will, at our school. Failure is not an option. We are consistently persistent. You can ask yourself, well, okay, it's easy to say we're going to believe that all kids can learn and all kids can learn. But we sat down and we asked ourselves some critical questions. And we got this when we were working through the DeFore work. And his critical questions and our critical questions are, if we believe all kids can learn, well, what is it that we want them to learn? We have to identify and be very clear about that. What is it we want them to learn? How are we going to know if they've learned it? And what are we going to do if they don't? because unfortunately sometimes they don't. So what do you do? What is it that we expect them to learn? We've focused on developing a standards-based instructional system that uses a student-centered approach to accountability. We are very, very focused on the Minnesota State standards. In fact, you can go into any of the classrooms and ask the teachers which standard they're teaching to, and they should be able to answer that. They should be able to connect with you what standard that they're working on for that day. The lesson might not go well every day, but at least the teacher should be able to verbalize what it is they're doing in their classroom on that day. We also maximize engaged learning time by using many different flexible grouping practices. Well, how will we know if we've learned it? One of the big contributors to our success has been our assessment program that we've put together. We monitor student progress diligently. And we use that progress to inform our instruction and also to change what we're doing with students. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what we do, and if you have questions, I can go into more detail. But the first thing we do is we use the NWEA test, Northwest Evaluation Assessments, and we give those tests 3 times a year to students in grades 2 through 6. We also use the DIBELS Next, which is the newer DIBELS program, and we use that as a benchmarking for all of our students in grades K through 6. Also, with students in grades K through 3, we've added the DRA, the Developmental Reading Assessment, and both the DIBELS and the DRA are diagnostic tools that will tell you that breaks the reading skill down for you into the different components, and it gives you a component score, but it also gives you which parts of reading aren't they getting. They might get the phonemic sounds, but they maybe aren't getting the blending. So you don't waste time teaching stuff they already know. You figure out what it is they don't know, teach it to them, and have them move on. And the DRAs are administered 5 times a year. So what do we do when we find out that we have students that aren't working up to grade level? Well, we've worked really hard at implementing a response to intervention process. In fact, we've been doing this for about 3 to 4 years. We identify students that are not working at grade level expectations, and we determine the exact area the student is struggling with, and we match an intervention to that student. Our interventions are provided in several different ways and usually are about 20 minutes. These interventions are research-based, and they're given by trained individuals. The fidelity of the intervention's implementation is also thoroughly documented. We wrote a grant a couple years back and received one from the Minnesota RTI Center, which has been very, very valuable to us in getting us going and helping us identify what interventions are research-based, how do we implement that. We actually had coaching for every week for 2 years with Ann Casey and the problem-solving group that she's had. It was wonderful. We've also connected with the Minnesota Reading Corps, where we have 2 members that come into our schools and provide interventions, one-on-one interventions to our students. These students that are receiving interventions are monitored weekly, and the problem-solving team meets each month to analyze the effectiveness of the intervention that was prescribed to that student. We also offer extended day opportunities. This is not a homework help time. This is a time where we look at where the students are, and we apply those interventions and make sure that the objective at the after-school program is matched with the objectives that they're learning within the classroom. And we also have some extended school year opportunities for kids. Our students have a real hard time with that 3-month break. And we've got documented, years of documentation that shows that our scores in the fall are never as good as they were in the spring, and so that catch-up time. So our extended school year has gone 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, 3 weeks off, and then school starts. And we also have beginning school conferences where we have parent-teacher conferences the first 2 days of school. It's a wonderful way to set the table for the new school year so people can learn where each other is at, both the family, the student, and the teacher. It takes that instructional core and kind of puts it all together. So we are a vibrant community of learners where adults and students alike seek ways to connect, communicate, collaborate, and create. We are all teachers and learners that continue to define and redefine and redefine what we are able to do. I would personally like to invite you to come and visit our school so you can see for yourself what Sibley Schools is all about. And I do have an invitation for each of you that I will pass out later. So thanks again for the opportunity to meet with you.
Thank you very much. And I think you addressed Senator Scheid's question quite amply.
Question? Madam Chair?
Yes?
Just a quick question.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very impressive story. How do you pay for the extended time? How is that funded? Is that part of the RTI grant?
Nope. We use our RTI grant Smartens. Is gone. We've used it up for some curriculum pieces and intervention pieces that we bought. But our extended school year and extended school days, we use targeted services money.
So
it's through our Riverbend Education Association.
Madam
okay.
Chair,
I'm not familiar with that
okay.
term.
Yeah, where does that money come from? Is that federal money, Title I money?
It's federally and state funded.
Targeted. Martin, we will investigate that.
Okay.
We'll get an answer to that.
Thank you.
It's,
okay.
it's targeted services. It's through our Riverbend co-op, our educational co-op.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up on the reading
yes?
question. Thank you, Madam Chair and Principal Martins. You described what you do in reading. I'm wondering how many students or what's the percentage of students that are proficient in reading at third grade, and what's that percentage when they leave your school?
Ms. Martins.
It varies. Different grade levels have different proficiencies. We're really proud of our third grade. We had about 80% of our kids proficient in reading in grade 3 in Gaylord. And one of the things we're especially proud of is our Hispanic students and the scores that they have. They're we're beating the state averages with that particular subgroup.
So. Okay, thank you.
I wish I could say it's 80% across the board. It kind of goes up and down. But.
Thank you. Ms. Donaldson.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Donaldson. I'm the director of Concordia Creative Learning Academy. We're 9 minutes and 22 seconds from here. I figured that out today. And really, I shouldn't be here. I mean, every time we do this, I get so nervous because my teachers should. They are the ones that are doing this. And I'd like to invite all of you to come over for lunch, 11 to 2. I know your stipends were cut this year, so I will buy you school lunch. Again, we can park in front of the school, no quarters needed. And please come talk to them at any time. I'm very blessed with those teachers. Again, we are located on the east side of St. Paul. We serve children from age 4 to 8th grade. We have about 389 children at this time. And a little bit about what we do. And what we do is we love what we do. That is our first mission. We love, we learn, we achieve, we succeed. We every day, 8:30 to 4:30 is our school day. That was based on a teacher request because our story is we were in danger of restructuring. We did not make AYP for 3 years in a row. Our third year, 98% of my children went up 2 grade levels, and we had a big party. A week later, we found out we didn't make AYP. And if we didn't make AYP the next year, it was the restructuring. So we changed everything that we did. We sat around, and we became data-driven. And that's the handout that you have in front of you, and I'd like to explain that a little bit more. But where some of why we do what we do, Saturday school, that is paid for out of title funds. So I'll answer that right away. We are there every Saturday from 8:30 to 2:30. We do not have money for transportation. We have about 50% of our children that come on Saturdays. 8:30 to 4:30, Monday through Friday, we have art, we have music, we have Phi Ed. My teachers eat lunch and go to recess with their kids, so I don't have any discipline problems at recess, but they do have a 2-hour prep every day to do that. We are year-round, and we are part of a learning year. 11 years ago when charter schools came in, there was a learning year, 0.2 ADM. And so we do get 0.2 ADM for our summer school, and we pay for that. So they're never away from us for more than 3 weeks. Because we assess in May using NWA, just like Mary Lou. And last year, we assessed them the last week of May. We assessed them the last week of December. 67% of my children returned to the score they had in May. So we decided they got to be there in summer, and they can't be away from us. And so that is why we have our summer program. We are not a teaching school. We're a learning school. I do not have time, I'm sorry, to teach people how to be teachers. When they come to me, they can learn, but they've got to love the kids and they've got to love the profession, and I will support them in any way possible. But if they have a difficulty with being a teacher and maybe that's not the profession for them, we counsel them out. And I don't mean to be mean or anything, but they got to be passionate about what they do, because our kids, 98% poverty, they have two strikes that it is. 67% of my parents don't have a high school education. So they're coming from generational. So that when I say we're not a teaching school, we're a learning school, we learn constantly. We are a school for children, not adults. Attendance is mandatory. We go pick them up. We buy them clock radios. You know, they're in school, and they want to be there, but sometimes they oversleep. Sometimes they miss the bus. We will go get them to be there. We don't have incompetent people at Goodwill. That's another story. Our children cannot afford to lose one day. We learn, play, cry together. We have the same beliefs. A lot of flexibility. If teachers need something, we work the schedule around so they get it. We don't complain. So a lot of flexibility, monthly celebrations. In our past, like I said, we didn't make AYP for 4 years, and now we've made it for 3 years. We went from 32% to 42% to 79% in reading. And one of the ways we did that is, we didn't teach social studies and science to the children that were behind more than three grade levels. But now we're there. They do have social studies and science now. They didn't then. And you'll find out that to improve reading instruction, they need three shots every day. And so they'd have 4.5 hours of reading a day and then a math. And that worked. And the other thing that we did is extend the day and Saturday school. But now we're getting to the point where now they are proficient. We're at 79%. It's still not good. We have 31% that aren't proficient. So technology is our next step to do that. Again, the teachers are the reason we made AYP. I cannot say that enough. The number one, I know other people think differently, in student achievement is the teacher. It is the teacher. We have a 4K program. We started them at age 4. Last year we had 44 children. For this coming year, we have 66 registered and 182 on the waiting list to get into our 4K program. They're wonderful. They're saints down there. I don't know what to do. I've never had a discipline problem. I don't know what I'd do with a 4-year-old that came to me. But that is key down there. Data. And that's the NWA sheets that you have attached. And I just want to, Charter School Partners, if you've heard of them, they have something called TRIO. Last spring, I gave every teacher an Apple laptop computer with a little card to go to the Apple store to learn how to use it, because 2% of my staff thought they were proficient in technology, so I gave them that. No raises for 3 years, but they got an Apple computer. That's because it came out of my title funds. And this is what they use to chart growth. You can see the names, the grade level. RIT score is what we use. RIT is from a Danish guy. You don't need to know that. But RIT just means where they are. As you can see over on the side, it's equivalent to a grade level. It's equivalent to their growth. And then we also align it, if you go on to the next two pages, to if they will pass the MCAs. So they need to know their score is no longer you need to be on grade level. Your goal is to be on this score at the end of the year, because this is how you pass the MCAs. Coming from the, everybody went up two grade levels and that didn't work. So as you go through here, I've taken a second and a third grade. We can tell you a second grader, and this comes from TIES and the TRIO program that Charter School Partners has. We can tell you a second grader what they need to have in reading to pass the MCAs at the end of third grade. So those become, and the greatest story this year is my second grade teacher. I sent an email, and her score, she had her goals higher than the goals here. I said, why do you have them higher? She said, because in December testing, they'd already met the end of their year goals. So now enrichment. We get to do enrichment and fun stuff like that. So that's why she did that. And again, on to eighth grade, you'll see that at the end there. We have some children at 12th graded. We are offering algebra this year because I have 17 children in grades 5 through 8 that are above the eighth grade level in math. And so we offer an algebra section, which is exciting. And so that's kind of the data-driven. On the last two sheets, you'll see what those numbers mean. So if I am a teacher and I have a child that scores a 209, this is the work they need to work on, exactly those skills they need to learn. And the last sheet shows which children are in those groups. So when I prepare my lessons, then those group of children are with me for that hour and a half based on these strands and what they need to learn. So that's how we use data. The teachers embrace it. I give them a lot of credit for doing that. We've had a lot of help from, I was in the Principal's Academy, that's how I met Mary Lou, and also MESPA with Fred has helped a lot this year, and then Charter School Partners has helped with the data and the NWA.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nelson, and all three of you. Are there questions? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. could you just give us an idea of, like, grade size, class size, for the different schools? And then maybe just talk a little bit about how does special education fit in? Do you have many in special ed, or?
Yep, we try
Martins.
To keep class. Oh,
did okay. You just you come through the chair, Madam Chair, and
okay.
Senator Stump.
We try to keep class sizes a little bit smaller in our kindergarten through grade 3. I would say there are about 23 or 24 students in each classroom, and then in grades 4 and 5, they run around 26, 27. We did have a class over 30, our 6th grade. We cut from 4 sections down to 3, which pushed our numbers up a little bit over 30. Presently, we're at 29, and 30. So that's about our class size. And with special education, what we really love about the response to intervention process that we use is as the children work through the process, we've hoped to find interventions that work for them so that they're reading before they leave grade 3, or particularly if they leave elementary school. But special ed has dovetailed into that process. So once we've determined they've had some straight line scores that we're not making any progress, we don't wait any longer, and then we kick it into child study, and then it goes into to special education process. But one thing I wanted to mention is we've reduced the number of referrals to special ed in the last 2 years by 33%. So just by catching those literacy skills early, especially with learning disabilities, the students that have learning disabilities. So,
thank you. Senator Nelson, I think you have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I just wanted to follow up, and maybe each of the principals and the director could tell me a little bit about your school structure. I can't tell if you're all charter schools. And then your enrollment numbers and your grade configuration. And then what I really want to know is the waiting lists. What does that look like for each of you?
Hey, Mr. Vincent.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson. Our grade configuration, I have a total of 1,100 students in the pre-K 8 campus. I have 2 campuses at 500 and something in the pre-K 4, which is my lower campus, and 590 something at the 5-8 campus. So combined, it's 1,100 students. Class size, regrettably, my class sizes are very, very high because we have a very long waiting list for each of the grade levels, very long. And we usually lose 10% over the summer, so we project to add 10% from the waiting list. Well, this year we were tricked. 10% did not leave. And so as a result, I have 5th, 6th grade classes with 35 students in them. Even my kindergarten classes have 27, 28 students. We have a large waiting list in each of those areas. And being a public school, we try to serve as many kids as possible. It has been traumatic for some of the teachers because of the large class size. But we don't use that as an excuse. We work with them. We know that we have many, many challenges with language impairments and what have you. So if you have correct discipline and teaching them what they need to do, then the impact of class size is not as detrimental. But it is an issue, and we do try to take it. But sometimes you get when you have a large waiting list and you want to serve, then you get caught sometimes.
Hmm. Madam Chair.
Ms. Donaldson.
Mary Donaldson. We have about 33% children in special ed, and we service them, but we use an integration model where they're in the classroom almost 80% of their day, unless they're three or more grade levels behind, which is 27% of my kids, they have to have the small group one-on-one instruction in order to catch up. And so they are pulled out for that, but they are, we test in August when they get there, we test in December, and then over Christmas break, we realign that, and we test in May again. So they're constantly, they're called flexibility groups. They're going in and out, and those children know their scores and know the goals they have to get in order to go on. Class sizes ranges around 20. 25 in kindergarten. I have two teachers in each room. Every child reads when they're done with kindergarten. That's why you put two teachers in each room. Grades 5 through 8 are multi-age based on their knowledge. They are gender-based in math and in reading. And again, flexibility, they're not tracked because every child can retake that test at any time, and they know, talk to Rosie, talk to Tyresha. They're in my office, Miss D, I want to take that test again. I'm out. I want to move up to the next group, so that's their choice. School configuration, we have two sections now, three of pre-K, two sections, K through 4, and then again 5 through 8 are ability grouped with different people. And 389 kids total. I think that's all the questions.
Are you a charter school or a regular public?
I'm a public charter, yes.
You're a public charter.
Yes.
And you obviously are a public school.
We're these a public kids, school, yes. Yep.
And I'm a public school.
You're a regular public school. So there's one charter and two regular public. I think Senator Daley was next.
Okay.
Sorry, and I'll get back to the
site. We had
12. One more, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I was just going to hear from Principal Martins about her enrollment instructor.
Yep. We have the number of students that we have. We have 1,201 students at Sibley East. About 665 students are in the elementary school. And we have two campuses. One is in Gaylord and one is in Arlington. And we have of three, it's about split. We have, because of facility issues, we have all of our sixth graders in Gaylord. So the two towns are about, the schools are about 9 miles apart. And you wanted to know about special, 12% of our students are in special ed.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Daley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way I understand it, you are like Top Gun schools. You're the best of the best. You've received these awards. And you said, Ms. Martins, that, and I don't mean this as a criticism, but I'm struggling to get to 100%. Failure is not an option. And you mentioned that 80% of the third graders are at the proficient level. By the end of third grade, they know how to read. What are the most common reasons that those 20% of the students are not able to read at that proficiency level? And what are your thoughts about getting closer to 100%? How do we get there?
Ms. Martin. Yeah.
Well, we're working hard and we're trying. And actually, some of our classes are a little bit larger than 80%. But 80%, we have to remember, they're not always starting at the same place either. So an 80% proficiency mark is good in some cases, but it is not 100%, and we are shooting for 100%. So we believe that they can still make it and that they can do it. They're just not there yet. And so one of the things that I think we're working really hard on is motivating the kids to really want to get there. And what we've seen is when we're using our data and the kids see their data and their kids can see, that's one of the things we really like about the response to intervention and all the interventions that they're getting, they can actually see themselves get better. They know that this week they're reading 43 words per minute. Their classmates might be reading 80 words per minute, but last week they were at 35. So I think the more time we spend on focusing, watching them get better, watching themselves get better, seems to be really motivating for us. But failure is not an option. We just keep going. And we're not there yet.
Okay. Thank you for all your efforts. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bonner.
These are questions for Ms. Donaldson. Ms. Donaldson, could you, you mentioned that you let teachers go. And so as a charter school, you may have more flexibility with the hiring and retaining teachers. And I'm wondering if you could talk about your teacher evaluation structure and process, and over what period of time, how many teachers have you actually ended up letting go? And then also, do your children wear uniforms?
Yes, they wear uniforms. It's wonderful. And we have extra ones in my closet in case they forget or they've been wearing the same thing for 15 days and it needs to be changed. No, uniforms are wonderful. If any of you have any kids, it's good for as a mother, too. The teacher, I spent 26 years in traditional. Okay, and I again, teachers are the reason why children succeed. I just feel sometimes, as with any organization, sometimes you're not a fit. We use the TAP program. Are you familiar with that, teacher evaluation? Mm-hmm. I love it because my teachers are the leaders. I just sit back and they do it. We have become a community school in that it is more of a community decision than it is my decision. They will come to me and say someone just is not fitting. We put them on the action plan. We say the things. Many times people come to me and say, Mary, I just don't fit in this school. Mm-hmm. And so how many have I... 6 years, right? This year, none. Thank goodness, because it's the hardest thing ever to do. Yeah. It's very painful, but my children, anyway. My first year, 4. Second year, 8. The next year, 3. And now this year, none.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. And Senator DeCrave? Or Senator Jayde, I think you were next.
Yes,
sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask Principal Vincent about... You mentioned a large number, a high percentage of English language learners or people who are speaking English as a second language. Can you tell me what model you use for teaching them English?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Vincent.
Senator Shide.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question. We're very proud of our English language learner program. It's dovetailed as one of the best in the country. And the model is inclusion. You know, we have those youngsters in the classroom with the teachers, and occasionally the ELL specialists will pull them. But for the most part, they're in the classroom with the teacher. This is a very arduous task because many times these kids cannot connect with the reading text. And I know that you have a high interest in reading. But we have been working diligently to give them multiple strategies to unpackage the text. A lot of it is vocabulary. We try to build vocabulary, teaching inferencing skills, the use of context clues. It is a struggle. I mean, some of the things that we take for basic stuff that you expect children to know, they simply don't have a clue. And every day I'm amazed by something. Today I learned that there were a group of youngsters that didn't know St. Paul. You know, they didn't have a concept of saint. You know, and we just take it for granted. And every day there's something that's being unpackaged about where these youngsters are and how limited their background knowledge is with reading. And, Senator, I also want you to know that every teacher is a reading teacher, not just the reading specialist, not just the English teachers. My social studies teachers, my science teachers, my music teacher, my art teacher, all of them at the 7th and 8th grade, have been given reading skills to support the reading.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Senator DeCrave.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll call it esteemed panel. I love hearing success stories, and it sounds like there's a common thread that I've heard, I think, from each of you, and that you give an awful lot of credit to your teachers. And I happen to agree. It's the teachers are the ones that touch the students, but it's the principals that manage those teachers. So you deserve a lot of credit. But I do want to ask you, what's the common link here? You all have shown some great success, and it sounds like your teachers are your key. What is it? Can you each speak some about your teachers and what your teacher staff is like? What's special about them that this group of teachers can reach these students and help them succeed where maybe some others couldn't?
Who wants to start?
What are you looking at me for? Okay.
I can do it.
Okay, Mr. Vincent.
You're speaking better than I am.
Well, I don't know
Mr. Vincent's job.
But, Madam Chair, Senator DeCrave. Thank you again for that question. It's a double-edged sword. You know, we have seen the difference between elementary teachers who are very, very nurturing. They want everybody to be happy and don't want the babies crying. to the point where you get to the secondary teachers and they become content focused.
Yep.
You know, I'm the expert, you have to know the content. Well, what we have done is to bridge the two together. We got our elementary children now focusing more on data, getting the job done, and the nurturing is still there, but we're not hearing, poor baby, poor darling, does his home life is terrible. We don't have those conversations anymore. They still exist. We still have a large number of youngsters coming with mental health issues that somehow nobody is addressing. Okay, so yes, some of them are struggling, but we've got to get them nurtured, and we've got our secondary people starting to care more. Care not only about the subject, but the student. And I've always said to the teachers, elementary and secondary, teaching has not occurred until the learner learns. And the learner must know that you care about them, that you know about them, and that you feel for them, and that there is some empathy about where there is. And that's why our district is embarking upon this massive cultural proficiency. Because schools are middle-class institutions, and so many of our youngsters don't have a clue about what it is to be in a middle-class institution. So we're having discussions with the faculty to be able to embrace what those babies bring to the table, and not to criticize them, not to change them, but to understand them. And that will make for a better teaching-learning process.
Thank you.
I think one of the things that I've noticed is that there are different styles of teaching. You have to be passionate. You have to love children. Everybody will say that. But one thing I believe makes a huge difference is they know their students. They know their students, and they know what they need to know next. So.
Ms. Donaldson, you ready?
Yeah. Chief Stallion came to me. He's a third grader and said, "Ms. D, I got my homework done." I said, "Great." Miss Leanne gave me a flashlight because when I'm in the closet, when Mom and Dad put me in there, and going back to, we do empathize, but that's not an excuse. I got my homework done because I have a flashlight. And that's what goes on with every teacher. It's not just one, it's not just two. And for the first time in 30 years, I can say that I would place my child in any classroom in my building. And I couldn't do that before. And so we've grown through that. We've transformed from enabling to understanding. Also, high expectations. High. I used to be discipline problems. Now it's they don't have their homework done. Every single child does homework from 4K through 8th grade every single night, or they don't go home. They're there till 6 o'clock. And it's enforced across. Everybody enforces it. And they're just good people.
Thank you.
Well,
Madam Chair?
Senator, we're here. And then we need to wrap up because I want to give some time for Don Fraser. So, Senator Regan.
Yes, very briefly. Madam Chair, yesterday we had a presentation from the Department of Education and the Data Quality Campaign. We're talking about data. And as you are aware, there's a $12 million second phase rollout for a data program, which ultimately is to help you. Do you feel connected with the department's program? For the longitudinal data, and they're talking about a lot of plans and information that's going to be available over the next several months. Pose the question.
Senator Weger, I suspect that they may not be as aware as we might be of what's out there in terms of informed decision making, where that is. We're learning, and right. We're going to put it to a test. I'm not sure if you're using the data that you're gathering about your students. And I think as you become aware of other links that you can take with that, we'll probably take advantage of it as well.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'd be curious if they're aware of it as, we're in the second phase of a rollout program.
I know.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm not too connected because I don't know about it, and maybe I should, but I'm a favor of data. But
Madam Chair, we get a lot of information from the state regarding data, regarding the goals and objectives, and all of the different programs that are associated with closing the achievement gap. I mean, so the state is very much aware of the gap, and they're aware of trying to train us to do it, and we're getting data all the time. I'm not sure I can speak specifically to what you are addressing, okay. But I know that the state is working very diligently to guide us, to provide assistance. And so we're making progress, and I feel connected. I feel that I can call the state and that we have agencies and people that we can call upon to talk about data and some of the things that's happening. And we're using multiple sources, so we're using a lot of data, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you very much, all of you, and congratulations, and keep up the good work. You're an inspiration to us as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we have Don Fraser, former Congressman Fraser and Mayor Fraser, co-chair of the Achievement Gap Committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts with you. About 4 years ago, a group of us decided to take a close look at the achievement gap, particularly in Minneapolis, but also in St. Paul. After several years of meetings and listening to folks who had something to tell us, I wrote up a statement about the conclusions that seemed warranted by what we had heard, and I'm passing out now the statement that I developed and circulated to the group, and I'm going to have that be the testimony I'll give you this afternoon. I should add, on the back of the sheet that you're getting is a list of the speakers or programs that we've heard over the last 4 years. I'd be happy to answer questions about any of them. The latest one that's scheduled is on here. It hasn't happened yet. It'll be next week. Al Fan from Charter School Partners.
Thank you.
Our group has heard from school leaders in Minneapolis and, in Minnesota and other states who report success in narrowing or closing the learning gap. These include both charter and public schools. Many schools are not making significant progress. The committee has sought to understand why. Last December, we met to identify some tentative conclusions. Children who arrive at school from a home culture supportive of education and or have had a quality preschool program are more likely to succeed in school. Surrounding the school with a community of support helps, but in-school factors that result in a positive difference include schools with strong leadership, more able to choose teachers, longer school hours, vigorously pursuing connections with parents, use of school uniforms, teachers work as a close-knit team, taking responsibility for the progress of all students, and students' progress is closely and continuously monitored with prompt action for a student falling behind. In sum, in effective schools, there is a consistent, rigorous commitment to all students. The concept of teachers working together has been described in several recent studies. The National Commission on Teaching in America's Future reported that teachers who are in, and I quote, engaged school-embedded professional learning teams, unquote, hold themselves to a higher standard, improve their practice, and lift student achievement. Karen Chenoweth, who writes for the Education Trust, spent the last 6 years identifying and visiting high-performing schools with significant populations of children living in poverty and children of color. She reports that although teachers in these schools work hard, they find their work invigorating because they are successful. And they are successful because their schools are organized with care to ensure that they do everything right from discipline to curriculum. She goes on to say that it is, however, unquestionably complicated work to ensure that just about all of their students learn to high standards. Schools need to do everything right which means they cannot afford to be sloppy about a single thing, from how teachers speak to children to how they organize their instruction. And note this statement. This is one of the major differences schools that mostly serve low-income children face as compared with schools that mostly serve middle-class students. Middle-class schools can tolerate some sloppiness and still look pretty good on most ordinary measures of success. Middle-class parents are more likely to have the time, energy, and resources to support their children academically, socially, and emotionally, and that support can often compensate for shortcomings in their schools, from inconsistent discipline policies to wishy-washy curricula. But schools that serve children who live in poverty or isolation can't afford to be sloppy about anything. Every single thing must be done with thought, care, and precision. And we concluded this with a statement, we now know what works. How do we make it happen? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fraser. Are there questions you have? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Fraser if you have thoughts on what we might do legislatively, since you have a legislative background, you know, is what can we do to conquer this, what I call the opportunity gap?
Mr. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Senator, one of the needs for our schools is to have really strong, well-trained principals. I know that the metropolitan schools grapple with that issue. There's a Minnesota Principals Academy. Both Minneapolis and St. Paul have their own principal academies. But my impression is that the effort to provide strong principals needs to be greater than is currently happening. Mm-hmm. I believe that one possible approach would be to set up almost a super principal category. I wouldn't use that term, but a principal who has demonstrated the capacity to lead and run an effective school. And I think they ought to be paid more. I'd pay them at least another $25,000 or maybe more. So I haven't really tried to flesh out the specifics, but I think that's a critical factor. Several people who work in this field have told me they've never seen a successful school that doesn't have a strong, well-organized principal who leads the school. And so I think the state, in providing, there are training institutions across the country who work on this, but of course it always costs money. If people are going to go to a training experience for 6 months or a year, they need to have some income and somebody has to pay those costs. But anyway, that's what I would put number one on my list. Also, and I know this is a topic you're interested in, I think this business of tracking students continuously is a critical element. And so that involves technology in terms of having the test results available. But we've heard from schools that do that. I was particularly struck. We had the superintendent of Duluth Schools down, and he was talking about having I've forgotten what he called it, a data coach in every school to kind of make sure that the data systems were functioning, the teachers were getting the data back, and that they could then use that to judge how their instruction performance, how well that was being carried out.
Mr. Fraser, last year when the state was going through the process of making an application for the Race to the Top,
you know, one of the criteria that was included in that was having a strong evaluation system or program for both teachers and administrators, principals. Do you have any idea? You see that as a critical role in working? You mentioned the Principal's Academy, but having some type of a structure that would enable an ongoing evaluation and strengthen them as they're on the job?
My hearing isn't perfect. Could the first part of your question, if you could just...
Well, I was relating to the fact that when the state was working on the application for the Race to the right. Top grant, that one of the things that they were looking for was whether the state had a system of good teacher evaluation as well as principal or administrator evaluation. And that's an area that I don't know that we have an organized one, but contributing to that whole quality, not only teacher quality but the leadership quality too. Do you have any suggestions or ideas on that that approach? Because it's working with them while they're on the job, the evaluation and being able to support, give some supports as they are functioning.
I don't know if legislation is required, but I do think that the Department of Education could focus on that challenge of having adequate evaluation. I think it's more fair to principals and teachers to have a really good evaluation. If they're doing good work, that should be recognized. And but that's in terms of a legislative initiative, that's not something I've really thought about. But I think it's a really important subject.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, Mayor Fraser, I came to one of your sessions, and people, it's in the basement of a church, and people bring bag lunches, and it's packed. And I was very struck by how, I mean, if you look at starting in April, you really haven't missed much. You go throughout the school year since 2007. You've got, you know, the widest variety of speakers really covering every important subject that touches what it would take to close the achievement gap, you know, renowned speakers who are expert in their field. So I thank you for putting that group together and for having this conversation. I think one of the reasons why we have such a focus on it is because people like yourself and the group that you've put together have raised and elevated this conversation. So I appreciate your work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator. I want to say I appreciate the fact that this committee is looking at these questions. From my perspective as former mayor of Minneapolis, I view this as the most critical problem in our city. So.
Thank you very much for the reinforcement. We have spent and we're going to continue to spend time on that as we grapple with both the policies that we need or the things that we should stay out of and let the folks do it, and also grapple with the financial situation as well. Thank you so much for giving us this time and sharing it with
us. Madam Chair, is it okay to ask Mayor one question?
Yes, Senator Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mayor, some large cities, and I believe Chicago, where Secretary Duncan had been the superintendent, they have a model where the city council, I believe, pretty much has what a school board would do as well. Just looking at what would be the best governance model to deliver for efficiency. Any thoughts on changing the status quo?
I think in Chicago the mayor was given the authority to appoint the school board, or then the mayor runs the schools in effect, as is true in New York, a little bit less so in Boston. I regard that as kind of a last resort fallback position, but I'm not sure in the Minnesota culture that this would necessarily be a welcome step. but there is growing concern about It's the fact that the schools are having difficulty. And I think our state would do best if you could focus on the specific steps that could really make a difference. Part of the problem, I'm sorry to go on, but part of the problem is there are so many pieces to the education picture that you can settle on any one of them and say, well, we need to do better on this or do that. But the core of the matter gets back to what's in this paper, I think. And so the problem is to get a focus on what will really make a difference. And I watched the two metropolitan, the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts struggle with this issue, but they're handicapped in part, I think, by their culture. I think the culture of a school system is extraordinarily powerful, and trying to change it is very, very difficult. And so the change almost has to come incrementally, but need to break out of old patterns and be sure that we're really being effective. One of the things I like about charter schools, they prove that you can educate all these children. I happen to be a public education advocate. I like the public education responsibility, but they've fallen short, and the charters have helped show that they can do better if they put their minds to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fraser. Seeing no further questions, I think concludes our session for the day. You've put a nice cap on it. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Any more homework?